Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is Lecture 9, Digital Cameras. So today we're going to be talking about some of the things that are really specific to digital cameras, like sensor sizes, some of the interesting myths that have come around because of the different properties of different sizes of cameras, most notably, for example, the fact that we have the smaller digital cameras, the compact digital cameras, that seem to exhibit a general trend of having a much larger depth of field than, say, a much larger camera, like an SLR. And this is certainly true, but the truth is actually a little bit more complicated than just saying it's inherent to the fact that it is a compact digital camera. We'll talk about that as well. But before we get to some of this stuff, of course, I did just want to talk briefly about the final project. So as you know, the final project specification was released last week, and if you haven't seen it yet, it's available online on the course website. And basically, the specification essentially just boils down to make one. So you do have to get approval from us first based on whatever idea you happen to have for your final project. That just involves a proposal that you'll email to us on a specified date, which I think will be probably, I think it's 3 weeks from now. And once it's approved, then you can get started on your final project. It is important to do the proposal. We won't accept a final project unless you have submitted and have gotten approved a proposal for that final project. But the final project really is meant to be very open-ended so that you can explore whatever it is that you might be interested in relation to digital photography. So maybe you came into this class and had an idea about some sort of photo that you wanted to take, or some class of photo, or some style of photo that you wanted to take. This is the perfect opportunity for you to explore that. If you don't have any ideas, well, I'll show you a couple of previous examples or a couple of previous final projects that we've shown or that some students have submitted in the past, just to give you an idea of the variation, the different types of things that you might be able to explore. So just because you have to do a final project and it's photo-related doesn't mean that it has to be a series of images. If you want to do a series of images that are perhaps related to some collection, or they're related just by nature of being a series, then that's certainly fine. You're more than welcome to do that. But you can also do something else as well. So some people, for example, have actually created like children's books with photographs and had a small story for them attached to it. And others have made a couple of like big movie posters, basically, for movie ideas that they have that they think would be fun and neat to implement. Others have done like covers of, so these are not examples, but you know, I'm just using them as generic icons. Some people have used the idea of magazine covers and done something with that. So full ads, product shots, making a fake magazine, that sort of thing. Others have actually made videos out of it. So you can take a variety of stop motion animation frames, for example, and combine them all into a video. Others have done things like make brochures that might be related to something that they need to do for work or something that they're interested in. Really, it doesn't matter what you want to do. What does matter is that it's of sufficient scope. So it should be more involved than one problem set, and it's probably better to have the scope of this project to be more along the lines of, say, two problem sets worth of photographs. So you know how much time and energy you devote to one problem set for those photos. You should expect to devote at least twice as much that for the final project. So another thing you can do also is to create your own website. And in fact, a couple of years ago, some people really took that idea to heart and created a website. So here's one example just to show you, where these are a bunch of photos of people's faces, and just through using some web technologies was able to recombine them in this sort of really fun, unique way, where you can actually create sort of a new face just by altering, by using these arrows to change either the mouth, the nose, or the eyes, and you can combine them to make some really sort of fun and interesting face depending on what you want. So other ones, let's see. Somebody decided that it would be fun to do sort of a children's style web page where all of the letters of the alphabet were found in places around Boston and photographed. So some of these apparently were pretty tough. And I guess she had to get a little creative when photographing for the letter C, for example, and taking a picture of some corona. But as you can see, there's a whole bunch of variation here and variety that you can use. Let's see, another website is this one. This idea was really could have been successful even as just a series of photographs, but this student thought it would be better to present it in a way that's very predefined. So by putting this into a web page, he was able to predefine how these photos are arranged and how they're visible. And they are basically a series of photos of storefronts around Boston. And it's interesting, I think, to take a look at some of these. And you may even recognize some of these places, but seeing them isolated in this way makes it sort of an interesting project. So we did have, of course, submissions that are not web pages as well. So, for example, one student decided to do several panoramas, and as you know, taking panoramas is not necessarily the easiest thing to do well. You can certainly do it, and it's not that hard to do it, but it's difficult to do well. And she really showed a mastery of this by, like this one, for example. It's very difficult to find any stitching in this panorama, even though there's movement going on in this, I forget exactly what it is, but I'll just call it a dojo, basically. So other examples include somebody that did a project that had just the theme of spoons. So just sort of a spoon as you would see it around the world and maybe even in new and interesting ways, just sort of showing a neat, fun side of cutlery. Let's see, do I have some more here? Of course, I do. There are always some that like to push the boundaries a little bit of what some people are comfortable with, and this student decided to take some photos of spiders. Let's see, I think I have maybe one more. Oh yeah, so here's one. This is like a kid's book, basically. Heavily photoshopped, as you can tell, but basically just a combination of images and text to create a children's book. Let's see, do I have one more? I think that's about all that I have. But this gives you an idea of what sort of things you might try, or something that you might want to do when attempting your final project. So certainly give this some thought. You do have a little bit more time to come up with a project proposal. It's something that you should probably start thinking about now, especially if you're not quite sure what you want to do. Start paying attention, looking around, and see if you can make a theme out of something, or that you can take a series of photos of, or something that you might want to attempt that is outside of the realm of just a series of photos, and start working with that for your final project. Are there any questions on the final project before we move on? Okay. So a couple weeks ago, one of the things that we talked about with regards to digital cameras was the dynamic range. So we defined the dynamic range as being what? What did we say the dynamic range was for a camera? There's a simple equation, but basically, what does it mean, and what is the dynamic range, and not in terms of an equation, in just layman's terms? How would we describe it? Okay, good. So that's a good way. So how well everything in a photograph is exposed, and maybe a little bit more specifically, we could say, well, it's the range of objects that are in dark regions to bright regions that we can capture with a camera. So there's a specific lower level of brightness below which we won't be able to capture any detail because it's just too dark for our camera to register the photons, or to be able to understand and read the photons and provide some detail. And on the other end, there's too much brightness for us to be able to capture some detail. So there's a specific range of brightness that we can use in a digital camera that helps us retrieve this the values in the scene. It helps us see the details that existed in the scene. And generally, if we have a scene that has very large dynamic range by itself, we know that it will be difficult to photograph, just because we might have something that looks like this, where there's heavy regions of shadow and very, very bright regions of sky. And when you take this photo, the dynamic range of this scene is just too large for our camera to capture without some help. And by help, I mean either adding or subtracting some of the light that's causing some of this problem. And now, obviously, it would be difficult to subtract some of the light from the sky, but maybe what you could do is if you had a lot of flash units, you could somehow illuminate some of the regions inside of the bridge and provide additional light to even it out a little bit. So I gave some numbers here, and these are very, very, very much approximations. We might say that digital cameras, or rather digital SLRs, have maybe 10 to 12 stops of range, whereas compact cameras have 5 for the really low end, like the camera phone type cameras, up to 6, 7, or maybe even 8 for some of the higher end compact cameras that we would have. Now, there are some additional difficulties when talking about dynamic range, and that is the actual file format as well. The JPEG file format only allows a certain range of values, and so we have to do something about that. But what we're talking about is outside of that scope. We'll get to that in a couple of weeks, but that's another problem altogether. How many values we can store in file format is altogether a different problem. So this was one of the things that we used as an argument for using the RAW format in your camera, because you are guaranteed using the RAW format to store as many bits as you possibly can off of the sensor and preserve the dynamic range of the camera in your final shot so that you have more latitude when modifying the image or processing it in software rather than using a JPEG file formats. And so the example that we talked about when referring to this idea of dynamic range was this bucket, having a bucket that is sitting outside in rain where the rain droplets that are falling down are photons that are coming from the scene. And so we might have a whole matrix of buckets, so a whole bunch of buckets in rows and columns that in combination are an analogy of sorts for our digital camera's sensor. And so we would say then that our dynamic range, you might recall, was the maximum number of photons that we could capture in this bucket divided by the minimum that we could actually read without error. So there's certainly a minimum. You know, if there are 0 or 1 photons in here, that's probably not enough for our electronics to read. We're getting better to that point that we can read very, very few photons, but it's not quite there yet. So we still have this error, this noise that can occur in regions, in very dark regions of an image that have very, very few buckets. So all of this is well and good, but this doesn't really address directly a lot of the concerns that we've been talking about. Like I just mentioned before, that compact cameras almost universally have worse dynamic range than their digital SLR cousins. And why is this? So let's take a step back from this technical detail for just a moment so we can talk a little bit about digital sensor sizes themselves. So realize that the size of the sensor inside of your camera is very much related to the size of the camera itself. If you have a big camera, you're much more likely to have a bigger sensor than you would in a very small camera, like in a compact camera or even a camera that is in a mobile phone, just some sort of really small, very tiny sensor. And there's a variety of sizes that are available for sensors. There's a number of standard sizes, and some of these sizes you can see here. And these are some of the compact camera sizes that you would traditionally see. So you'll notice that they have different widths and heights. Their aspect ratio is pretty much almost always the same, of 4 to 3. So however many pixels wide, there's going to be 4 of those for every 3 pixels down. And that's generally true for compact cameras, that sort of aspect ratio, which is relatively square. It's not that rectangular. And this is, incidentally, the same aspect ratio, if you remember those old TVs before, you know, HD TVs, flat screens, you know, the big honking TVs, those also had an aspect ratio of 4 to 3, just to give you an idea of what that aspect ratio might look like. So each of these have that aspect ratio, and they all have a given size. And so they have, you'll notice that they're generally called by one size, like this one on the far left, for example, is 1 over 2.7 inches, and then the one in the center is 1 over 1.8 inches. And these don't really correlate very well to the actual physical dimensions that make up the sensor itself. Like if you actually looked at the diameter, the diagonal line of this one, for example, and yes, it's given in millimeters, but it's not going to be the same as 1 divided by 2.7 inches. The reason for this disparity actually goes back to some history from a long time ago when we had these tube amplifiers, basically. There would be these tubes that would be circular, and then in the very center of these circular tubes would there be a rectangular sensor. And these were the old television cameras from way back in the day. And those tubes are actually correlated to this size. So this size tube, 1 divided by 2.7 inches, for example, would actually give you a resulting sensor size that looks like this. So that's what these circles around each of these sensor sizes mean. It really is related to just this ancient way of marking the different sizes between some of these sensors. Yes? Right, so the circles have nothing to do with the sensors other than this historical way of marking them. And so this makes it a little bit more confusing, though one of the things that we can do is compare the relative sizes of the sensors based on their markings. So a 2/3 inch sensor, for example, which is actually a pretty common size in compact cameras these days, is a bigger sensor than these other ones, 1 over 1.8 and 1 over 2.7 inches. But it's without knowing the specifications, you don't know the raw size of the sensor itself. So I'm just using this mostly as a warning of saying just because they're using some known way of calling this size sensor, it doesn't mean that it's directly related to it. So there's no way of knowing the actual dimensions unless you know that 2/3 actually means a sensor of this size. And there is a way that we can actually find this correlation. That is, unfortunately, to use a table. So there's available tables around the internet where you can find the corresponding sizes of these sensors based on whatever name they were provided originally. So, for example, you'll notice here in the type line we have some of the ones that we had mentioned before. So 1 divided by 2.7 inches, for example, this one right here has that aspect ratio of 4:3, and you can see it gives us the diagonal size, the width and the height, and the, let's see, and that's basically it, the diameter of that original tube that I mentioned that's, again, listed for historical reasons but not really useful for us nowadays. And then even the 2/3 inch type, which is now actually a pretty considerable increase in size, you can see that the diagonal size is 11 millimeters compared to that 1 divided by 2.7 inch, which was only 6 millimeters. So we have a much larger sensor in this 2/3 type than we did in that much smaller sensor. Now, as we increase in size, these two down here, 1.8 inches and 35 millimeter, these are the two types that you're most likely to see in a digital SLR. So 35 millimeter film, this is the original size of a 35 millimeter film frame. When you went to a store and back in the day and you got some film, the size of the negative was called 35 millimeters, and that's the same size that we're referring to today. And you'll notice that these aspect ratios differ slightly. They're actually 3:2 rather than 4:3, so they're a little bit more rectangular than some of these compact camera sizes. But we can see that these are relatively huge compared to some of the smaller compact camera size sensors. So 35 millimeter film, for example, has a diagonal size of 43 millimeters, and compare that to that 2/3 size, which was 11, we can see that we have again nearly quadrupled, at least by diagonal, the size of this the size of this sensor. Now 1.8 inch, this is most likely you're not going to find very many 35 millimeter size digital sensors. These cameras tend to be very, very expensive. And people say, well, it's because the sensor is much more difficult to produce because it's a larger size. And that's certainly true to a degree, but it's also sort of a fact that that a lot of these manufacturers like to differentiate their models in just a very distinct way. So putting the larger sensors in the more expensive models, it just sort of comes with all the other features. So it really is more than just the sensor that you have a lot of these camera models being more expensive with the larger sensor. But still, it is to a degree the fact that these bigger sensors tend to be more expensive as well. But anyway, this 1.8 inch size, this is the most common for a digital SLR. This has a variety of names dependent on the manufacturer. So Nikon, for example, calls it the DX format. Canon, for example, calls it the APS-C format. And all of the manufacturers have this different name for it, but it all basically means the same thing. or rather, Canon calls it EFS, and other manufacturers call it APS-C. Well, let's see. It really depends. These are all sort of the names for the same thing, for the same size sensor. And they do vary just ever so slightly from one manufacturer to the next. They might be 1 millimeter bigger in one manufacturer compared to another manufacturer's APS-C sensor, but in the end, it doesn't matter. This we can call all of those by this 1.8-inch or APS-C name. And all of these, incidentally, are huge sensors compared to the sensors that we would see in the compact camera. And this makes a big difference. So just to give you an idea of how big of a difference this actually makes, I've drawn to scale here two different sensors. One is an APS-C, so it's not even the full frame 35 millimeter size, and the other is a 1 divided by 2.5 inch sensor. And this one might be kind of typical in a smaller compact camera. And you can, because these are to scale, you can actually see the difference in size between the two of these different sensors. So let's assume for just a moment, just bear with me for just a moment here. Let's assume that both of these sensors are in cameras, and both of these cameras are advertised as having 6 megapixels, which means that we have 6 megapixels in the sensor on the left. We have 6 megapixels on the sensor on the right. Now, what does this mean for the size of the individual pixels in these sensors? Yeah, so the one on the right will have much bigger pixels just by nature of the fact that we have the same number of pixels and we have a much larger area to work with. So how much bigger is it exactly? So you can see that I've also given some sizes to these. So the left, for example, is a 7 millimeter width on this sensor, and on the right, on the APS-C sensor, is a 24 millimeter width. So if we actually did some math and we figure out, okay, well, if we have 6 megapixels, that means that we have probably 3,000 pixels across by 2,000 pixels down, right? That makes sense, for 3,000 times 2,000 is actually 6 million pixels. So we can divide 7 millimeters by 3,000 to figure out the width of each of these pixels. And the width of each of these pixels is a very small amount. Please hold. I'm back. Okay, so the one on the left, we have a pixel size of 2.3 microns. And this is very, very small. Just to give a comparison, the width of a standard average human hair is 100 microns. So we're talking about a 50th the size of that is the width of one of these pixels in this small sensor. Just to make this a little bit more concrete, the cameras that are available for loan from the Church Street Lab, the Panasonic Lumix cameras, use this size sensor. Compare that to something you would find in a typical digital SLR, this size, and now you can start to see why this Panasonic camera might struggle a little bit with some of the light characteristics. Okay, but continuing on with this idea, so if we do the same math on the sensor on the right, we determine that actually has a pixel width of 8 microns. And that's about 4 times larger. So if we actually calculate the area of one of these pixels, we could just square both of these, so we could approximate. We could say that the area of the pixel on the left is about 4 microns squared, and the area of the pixel on the right is about 64 microns squared. This is a huge jump in the area that is available for one pixel. And we can see that here. I mean, even if we get rid of all of this other stuff and we just assume that this is the relative difference to scale in one pixel, we can see that we are dealing with a much, much larger pixel on the camera on the right. And what did we say? Remember back to one of the first lectures when we talked about aperture and f-number. One of the things that we talked about was the amount of light that you capture is directly proportional to the number of photons, or the brightness of the light is directly proportional to the number of photons that you capture. So if you have an aperture, and if you have that aperture that lets in twice as much light, that's a stop of additional light that you have to work with, basically. And that's the same sort of idea here. This area on the right actually collects 4 stops worth of additional light than the one on the left. Just because you have this one on the left, and you multiply it by 2, and that gives us an area of 8 microns. You multiply it by 2 again, that gives us an area of 16 microns. Multiply it by 2 again, 32 microns multiplied by 2 once more, 64 microns. So it's four stops additional light that's provided to us in this much larger sensor. Right? So there's just more light. And this is really, really important. If you can capture more photons in one pixel, then you're much more likely to be able to capture darker regions of the image, just because it's much easier to fill up, or it's much easier to capture more rain with a larger bucket than it is with a tiny little bucket. It's the same idea here. The larger the bucket, the more rain you'll capture, the more photons we'll capture in our sensor, and the easier it is for the electronics to read the available light that exists. Okay, we're going to come back to this in just a second, but there's another really important aspect of this difference in size, and that is, assume that we have just one lens. We have one lens and we have two cameras. These two cameras are identical in every single way except for these different sensor sizes. So we have one camera on the left. It's a big SLR. It has a lot of features, you know, whatever you want to do with it, and it has this tiny little sensor in it. Then you have another SLR. It's the exact same SLR, except now you have a much larger sensor in it. Okay? And now let's assume for a moment that you put a lens on top of the first camera, the one with the tiny little sensor right here, and you take a picture. Now you remove that lens off of this smaller sensor camera and put it onto this larger one, and you take another picture. So even if these sensors have the same number of megapixels, how do these two images, how are they different? Or are they at all? Yeah.
You're still getting more input from the larger sensor camera because it can take in more information.
It can take in more information. So yes, that's right. But can you be more specific? What type of information is it able to capture more of? Okay, right. So that's a very good point. Not the one that I want to make, but that is right. That the larger one, because it does have a larger area, will capture more photons, so we have a better signal to noise ratio. And that's certainly true. I don't want to diminish that fact at all, because that's something that I just talked about and we will come back to as its importance becomes a little bit more clear in just a moment. But I'm talking about, if assuming all of that stuff is the same, and we took these two images, how else are they different? Is there another way that they're different? Yes?
The one on the left have artificially zoomed in more than the one on the right.
Right. So essentially what's happening, if you have this little sensor on the left, essentially what's happening is that you're taking only a small fraction of the image that's being projected into the back of the camera by the lens. So if you take that image and you look at these two images side by side, because they're both 6 megapixels, if you look at them both side by side on your computer, you would notice that the one from the left looks like it's zoomed in more, even though we've used the same lens on the two. So just to give you an idea, this is the same sort of idea that happened when we were talking about perspective. Realize that, again, perspective is not doesn't change when you just zoom in or zoom out more, but instead perspective changes when you get closer or farther away. But we showed you this diagram as an example of this. And one of the things we said was that we took an image like the one in the far left-hand corner at, say, 33 millimeters. And then what happens if you crop out this center part and zoom in? So number 3 right here, it looks the same as number 2, and you'll notice that number 2 is actually a crop from that red portion of the image up there. These two essentially look the same, that image in the upper right and in the lower left. So in effect, what's happened is this same thing. We have just cropped out the center portion of the image, and by blowing it up, it looks like we have zoomed in quite a bit. So we would say that our angle of view has been cropped. The angle of view is basically just the angle through of the scene that we can view in its entirety. So we have a larger angle of view when it's something is more zoomed out, like we do in this number 1 image in the far left. We have a narrower angle of view when we are zoomed in or when we crop, as you can see in this image in the lower left and the image in the upper right. So just to give you another idea, let's assume that we have a lens that projects an image of a mountain. And recall that lenses are circular, so it projects this circular image like you see right here. Now, if we had a full-frame sensor, if we had a 35-millimeter sensor, we would take a picture of this image circle that's provided by the lens that looks like this red box right here. And you can see that it gives us a certain view of this scene that we're trying to capture. Now, if we take this same image, if we attach this same lens, rather, to another camera that has a smaller sensor attached to it, not attached to it, but inside of it, like this APS-C size sensor, for example, and we take another picture, what we're doing is we're cropping out even more of this image circle, and that's this blue rectangle that you see here. So even though these images provided by the lens are the same, in effect, what's happening is that we're getting a bit of a zoom out of this camera. So if these two sensors have the same number of megapixels and you view them side by side on your computer, what it's going to look like is the one that was taken with blue, in this blue crop right here, is going to look more zoomed in than the one that was taken with the larger sensor, with this red rectangle that's right here. So this is actually a very important thing that people talk about with relation to digital photography. They actually talk about how there's this cropped image circle, how there's this cropped magnification that can occur when you're using a smaller sensor with a large lens, with a lens that's meant for a 35-millimeter camera, but you instead use it on a camera that has a smaller sensor, you're going to, in effect, magnify the results of this lens. It's going to be as though you're using a more zoomed in or a longer lens. Now, just to give you another idea about this, let's say that we use, and let's put some concrete numbers behind this now. So let's say that we use a 50-millimeter lens on a full-frame camera, and we take a picture, and we're doing this of a portrait. And that's what, and I realize this is not the easiest to follow, but bear with me, it will become very apparent in just a moment. So we're looking at the image at the very top left. This is an image of this is just a scene of a portrait that we're trying to capture. We use a 50-millimeter lens, which is just a normal lens, and capture an image with a full-frame camera. What we get is this red rectangle in the upper right-hand corner. With our full-frame camera with a 50-millimeter lens, it looks a bit like this right here in the upper right, this red box. Now, let's say for a moment that we use this same lens on another camera whose sensor is smaller. It's a cropped sensor, in other words. It's this APS-C size sensor. And while it's still big, it's not quite as big as a full-frame sensor. And you can see, And now we can see through this blue square, this blue rectangle, how much more of this image we are cropping out because of this. This is very similar to what we just saw. In fact, it's almost exactly the same thing. Instead of a mountain, we're looking at a person. This is the same sort of idea. So what we're doing is we're taking another picture with a smaller sensor, and that the resulting image looks like this, this blue rectangle down here. But if we make this image the same size as the original full-frame image, in effect, what it looks like is that we've zoomed in, right? Because it looks like we're more zoomed into this person's face than it did when we took the original image. Now, you might say for a moment, well, okay, if it looks like we're zoomed in, why don't we just use, on a larger full-frame camera, why don't we use a longer lens to simulate the same thing? Is it possible that we can get the same image with a longer lens? And indeed, it is. Depending on the ratio of the change from one sensor to the next, we can determine exactly what size of a focal length we need to capture the same image. So now notice that we have two images, this blue image, which we had taken from our cropped sensor on a 50-millimeter camera, and we made it the same size as a full-frame image, and now we've calculated a new focal length. There's a new focal length that we put onto our full-frame camera. We took another picture with it, and it looks exactly the same as the cropped one. And in fact, we can see that at about 70 millimeters, that exact thing will happen, just because 70 millimeters happens to be enough of a change to overcome this now subtle magnification that can happen It's wrong to call it a magnification. What it is a crop. It's not a magnification. It's that you're cropping, and because you're making the image appear the same size on your computer screen, it appears as though it's magnified, right? Which is what we did here with this blue rectangle. We made it the same size as the other images, and it looks as though it is now magnified in some way. So in this manner, do we have cropped sensors that basically give us for free longer lenses? It changes the focal length. They don't change the focal length of any of these lenses, but instead, just by cropping out a smaller portion from the center and you on your computer blowing it up to be the same size as the rest of the images, does it look like you are using a longer lens? And so there's this focal length multiplier that we can apply to lenses dependent on the ratio of the smaller sensor to the larger sensor. So the smaller sensor, the APS-C sensor, is actually about 1.6 times smaller than the full frame lens, than the full frame sensor. You can calculate this by looking at a table, just like what we had done, and dividing any one of the sides. So you could take 43.3, for example, divide it by 28.4, and that will give you 1.6. You could do the same thing with 36 divided by 24-ish. You know, again, these numbers for APS-C vary slightly from manufacturer to manufacturer, but still, in effect, you will get either a 1.5 magnification factor or 1.6 for pretty much all of the APS-C sensors. And let's see. And just to give you an idea about this, I will bring up a calculator and show you what I mean. So we'll just take the diagonal length, for example, of the full frame sensor, which was 43.3, and we will divide it by the diagonal length of the smaller one, 28.4, divide. And we can see that what we get is about 1.5. Now, on Canon cameras, the difference is about 1.6. On Nikons, I believe the difference is about 1.5. Again, there's some variation that changes this multiplication factor. But what this means is that if I put a 50 millimeter lens onto my cropped camera, and the camera that I have is indeed cropped, and so I have to multiply by this magnification factor. If I put a 50 millimeter lens onto this camera, to figure out what the equivalent focal length on a full-frame camera would be, I would take 50 times the multiplication factor. So I would do 50 times 1.6, and I would find out the approximate size of the focal length. So at 80 millimeters, for example, on an 80 millimeter lens on a full-frame camera would give me the same angle of view as a 50 millimeter lens would on my cropped camera. Does this make sense? The fact that there's this multiplication, there's this method that we can use. If we take any of these sensor sizes, so if you had any sensor size, and there's going to be a little bit of error, of course, if you are dealing with sensor sizes with different aspect ratios, but still, it's a reasonable approximation to divide the diagonal of the 35 millimeter frame by the diagonal of the smaller sensor. So if we have a much smaller sensor, for example, this one that I was talking about before, 1 divided by 2.5, we see that its diagonal size is about 7.2. We can figure out the difference now in this multiplication factor. So we take 43.3 millimeters, which is the diagonal size of this very large full-frame camera. We can divide that by 7.2, which is the diagonal size of this smaller sensor. When we perform this division, we find out that the full-frame camera is actually almost exactly 6 times bigger than this much smaller sensor. So that means that if I am going to use a lens that's 50 millimeters on my big camera, on my full-frame camera, then I have to use a lens that is essentially, what, it has to be essentially, oh my gosh, I'm blinking on this now. It has to be essentially 8 millimeters on this smaller sensor to get the same angle of view. So if I take a picture of all of you and I want to get the same amount of the frame in this smaller sensor, I have to divide that factor by 6 to determine what would be an appropriate focal length to match that angle of view on this cropped sensor. And again, the reason isn't that we're changing the focal length. The focal length itself doesn't change. A 50 millimeter lens is still a 50 millimeter lens. It's just that we're taking a smaller portion from the center of it and blowing it up, in effect, cropping it and magnifying that crop so that it looks as though we are using a more zoomed in lens, a longer lens. So it just gives us the effect of having a longer lens. It doesn't actually give us an actual longer lens. There's a subtle but important difference between the two, if that distinction makes sense. Now, let's see. So this can pose, and this actually has posed a bit of a problem for digital SLRs that have cropped sensors, because if you want a really wide angle, you're going to need a very low focal length. And if you were going to have a low focal length, typically what you would find on a full frame camera, the lowest focal length you would typically find is maybe 14 millimeters, 16 millimeters. That's really wide, okay? That's almost 180 degrees. I mean, you're getting a lot of the scene. You're pretty much guaranteed to get your shoes in the shot if you take this photo just standing up straight. And if you put the same lens, though, on a digital SLR camera with a crop sensor, you can imagine that it is not going to be as wide anymore. And this is, in fact, a problem. And the way that manufacturers have combated this problem is to design lenses that have smaller focal lengths, but they're designed only for the smaller compact, the smaller cropped sensors. So this lens, for example, is what Canon calls an EFS lens. And Nikon has its own similar range called, I think, DX lenses, which basically are designed to be used exclusively on cameras with the cropped sensor. And the reason for that is that they do have a lower focal length, but in order for them to do that and to do it well, they can no longer have an image circle that is large enough to support a large sensor like a full-frame sensor. So the image circle on these digital specific lenses, on these lenses that are designed for cropped cameras, might actually be much smaller than this very large circle you see here. It might be just large enough to actually fill the entirety of a cropped sensor. And so for this reason, you don't want to. It's not advised that you use one of these digital lenses. And I'm calling them digital lenses. That's just that's what some of the manufacturers use as sort of a marketing term. There's nothing inherent about them being digital versus the other lenses. It's just that they're designed for these digital cameras because of this cropped idea. So I should say that these lenses that have been designed for the cropped image cameras, for the cropped sensors, have a smaller image circle. And if you use one of these lenses, and not all of them will actually fit onto their larger framed cousins, but if you use one of these lenses, what you will see is that you will get blacked out corners. You will actually see that your frame is a bit like a circle. And the reason for that is that the image circle itself is smaller. It's designed only for these smaller sensors, and it won't have enough of this scene presented onto this larger frame to be useful. But frankly, it's not that big of a loss, just because you already have probably pretty good wide-angle lenses that exist for full-frame cameras. Where it does become a bit of a loss is that if you have a mixed equipment, if you have one camera that's a crop sensor, another camera that's a full-frame sensor, and you want to use the same lenses across both of them, you really won't be able to share these lenses designed for the smaller sensors just because of this image circle problem. So this is an important distinction, and this is why this EFS mount, for example, exists. On the Canon line, there exists a variation. So the mount itself, this actual metal piece, is called an EF mount, and it is designed in a certain way, and all EF lenses will fit onto this mount, and they have designed a subset called EFS, and it's ever so slightly different. And so this EFS lens will only fit on cameras that support the EFS mount. Full-frame cameras do not support the EFS mount for this very reason that I described before, where you will actually see this problem with the image circle. And so these EFS lenses just will not fit onto a full-frame standard EF camera. Now, Nikon, though, what my understanding of what they do, and again, I'm less familiar with their range of lenses, but as far as I know, the DX lenses still do fit on most of the full-frame image cameras, but some of the full-frame cameras will actually then recognize the fact that these smaller lenses are attached to it and will automatically just use center portions. It will just automatically crop the center part of the image out to begin with. And so this is sort of a interesting and unique way of combating this problem on their end. Okay, now if we're talking about this same idea, so if I say, for example, that I have a 6mm lens on this Panasonic camera, now, and in fact, if we actually take a look at the raw data that's provided to us by the Panasonic camera, we see that its focal length range is 6mm to 72mm. This is what we've seen before when we talked about lenses. It gives us data on the lens itself that tell us a little bit about the focal length, tells us a little bit about the aperture, the f-number range that is available here. And we can see that this focal length range on this lens is 6mm to 72mm. And recall that I said that a 16mm lens on a full-frame camera, that's pretty wide. That's a very wide lens. That's something that would give you most of your shot in, or most of the scene in your shot. Now, this, if you put this lens, if you somehow disattached this lens from this camera, put it in front of a full-frame camera, what you would expect to see then is, you know, very, very wide shot. But again, this lens is designed for a much smaller sensor. So the image circle is smaller, so you're just going to get a little tiny circle. But what this does tell us is that we can multiply by that crop magnification factor to determine what this lens would be equivalent to if it were on a 35mm camera. So if I take this 6mm, which is its widest value, multiply by 6, which we calculated was the multiplication factor between this Lumix camera and the larger camera, we determined that in a 35mm equivalent of this lens starts at about 36mm or so, which isn't terribly wide, but it's certainly wider than our normal 50mm lens. So this is fairly wide, just not super wide, as we would call some of these other lenses. Now, if we see the other end of the spectrum, it goes all the way up to 72mm at the longest end for this lens. So if we take 72 multiplied by 6, we find that the 35mm equivalent of 72mm on this camera is 432mm. This is, if you've seen a 400mm lens on a 35mm camera, this is a monster of a lens. 400mm is absolutely huge. It probably weighs 7 or 8 pounds. It is all metal, all glass, and it's probably literally this big, something like this. And this is a big lens, okay? This is not something that you would easily be able to carry around. And so again, this is sort of the advantage of compact cameras. Just because this lens is now a maximum of 72, which doesn't sound that impressive by itself, but when you take into account this crop magnification factor, do we realize that we actually have a very capable zoom lens on this camera? Because we would not be able to use, if we wanted to get the same angle of view, so again, the equivalent of 430mm on a 35mm camera is very narrow. It's very, you know, you're really zoomed in on this scene, essentially. And you're allowed that on this camera here. It has that capability. 72mm is not difficult for these, for a camera of this size. But if you wanted to have this equivalent zoomed in capability on a 35mm camera, this is my argument that it would be very hard to do. It's a big, heavy lens, and you're not going to be able to do it very well. So there is an advantage to having these smaller sensors cameras, just because you can then have smaller lenses and you would be able to carry them around a bit more easily. But as we talked about before, it's not all rainbows and roses in the world of compact cameras, because you are actually also decreasing the size of the pixels, and that is certainly a bad thing. So let's take a 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll talk about why having smaller pixels is worse. Welcome back, everybody. So before the break, we were talking about this focal length multiplier, or there's this the difference in the size between the sensor in your camera to compared to the size of a typical film camera, or to the typical 35 millimeter frame, allows us to talk in a very standard way about the focal lengths of a camera. So whereas on this lens, we see that this camera has a focal length range of 6 millimeters to 72 millimeters. That doesn't tell us a lot about what we can expect out of it based on what we know about focal lengths on a typical 35 millimeter camera. In other words, we know that a 50 millimeter lens is a normal range, and 35 is wide, and 80 is starting to become sort of telephoto. So we can use this focal length multiplier to talk about our focal length range in terms of a 35 millimeter camera. So what we did before the break was we said, okay, the focal length multiplier of this camera is 6. So that means that the 35 millimeter equivalent lens, or in other words, a lens that we would have to put onto a 35 millimeter camera to give us the same field of view in this zoom range, would be a 36 millimeter at the wide end to 430 millimeter at the long end. And so this just allows us to compare apples to apples, in other words, so that we can actually compare focal lengths in one standard way of talking about them, rather than trying to compare 6 to 72 as that compares to this lens, which is a 10 to 22. What does that actually mean? The 10 to 22 on this camera, because it's a crop factor, is actually translates in terms of 35 millimeters to 16 to about, I don't know what, 45 or something like that, or no, that's probably a little bit low, to about 35, I think, is what it is. And then we can see that, okay, well, at the longest end, when I zoom this lens in all the way, that is the same view of the scene that this lens would get completely zoomed out. And I know that just because I compared the two of them in terms of one known factor, or in other words, in terms of this 35 millimeter range. And so using this is just the standard way that we can compare the focal lengths of one camera to another. And that's really where this focal length multiplier really comes into handy, is when you're comparing cameras or comparing the capabilities of these lenses. Now, as we talked about, it's not just because it's smaller, though, doesn't mean that it's very good. And in fact, in photography, the old adage really does become true: size does matter, very much so. It really, really does. And the fact of the matter is that it's just because of physics. The bigger your bucket is, the more photons you're able to capture. That's the simple fact of the matter. And yes, we can improve our electronics so that we will be able to get rid of some of the noise that exists, but it's not going to become perfect. It's not going to overcome the fact that a bigger sensor in general will perform better than a smaller sensor. Now, we've talked about at the very beginning of the lecture, I said that there's this idea that smaller compact cameras tend to have a much larger depth of field. So if you're using a compact camera, you may have been frustrated early on in the course when you said, okay, well, it's not, I don't see how I'm able to get something that has such a blurry background as some of the photos that I've seen in the remainder of the class. And this is something that is, I mean, this is something that is demonstrably true, that we see in compact cameras all the time, that it is, they just do not have the depth of field, or this shallow depth of field, that gives us the really milky, smooth background blur that we expect out of these digital SLRs. And the truth of the matter is, though, it's not just by the fact that it is a cheap camera. It's not the fact that it's the sensor itself is small. It really boils down to just all of the physics that are involved with scaling down a camera down to be a smaller size. And one of the things that I'm about to describe to you, you'll actually see that the larger cameras, it's not that these larger cameras are not capable of having such a large depth of field, but instead, while we can have the large depth of field in these cameras, we have the option of not using them. Basically, the capabilities that we get in a compact camera are a subset of the capabilities that are provided by a larger camera. And it doesn't matter, yes, technology matters. The newer technology is going to be a little bit better in terms of the signal, et cetera. But beyond that, the bigger cameras will just always be able to do more than the smaller cameras. And to understand that, I brought up this diagram once again. But we're going to look at this diagram just ever so slightly differently. In this case, what we're going to do is we are going to deal with two sensor sizes, but rather than these two sensors having the same number of pixels, which in effect means that the smaller sensor has smaller pixels, we're going to keep the size of the pixels the same, meaning that the smaller sensor has to have fewer pixels. Okay, everybody follow with that so far? So basically, if we keep the pixel size the same in this large sensor, which we're calling 6 megapixels, and this smaller sensor, then we know that this smaller sensor must have fewer pixels. If we do the math, we find out that the smaller sensor will actually have 0.5 megapixels. That's actually, to scale, how many fewer pixels it will have compared to this much larger sensor. Now, when we're looking at this, if that means that 0.5 megapixels is about 875 pixels across by 571 pixels, give or take a pixel, down. That's not very much. 800 or 900 by 600, that's not very much compared to 3,000 by 2,000 in this case. Okay, but let's keep this in mind. This is the new constraint that we're working with. We're using the same pixel size, but we have fewer of them in the smaller one. So now, if we again have two identical cameras with one lens, we take a picture on one camera with the bigger sensor, we take another picture on the other camera that's identical in every way, except that we're using the smaller sensor, we take a picture on this one. Now, what in effect is different? So do we have, let's think again about these two properties that we talked about before. The first one being the decrease in light. Do the smaller pixels mean that we are capturing fewer photons? Or does the smaller sensor now mean that we are capturing fewer photons on the pixel level, on each pixel? So because the pixels are the same size, we're not. We're capturing the same number of pixels in the center. If we took out the very center 0.5 megapixels of this bigger camera, they're capturing the same quantity of light as this smaller one right here, right? Just because the pixels are the same size, so we're capturing the same amount of light in both. Okay, but what is it that we're losing out on with this smaller sensor now? If we're using the same, and a big hint was the entire first hour of this lecture, if we're using the same lens on this one camera with the bigger sensor, we put the same lens on the smaller sensor, what are we losing? We're essentially cropping out the center, so we are... We're losing resolution. We're losing the center portion of the image. We're losing what's called, effectively, spatial resolution. So we would see, essentially, that this smaller sensor is just exactly as if you were to go in, take this sensor right here, take a photo with it, go into Photoshop, crop out the center, and that's it. That is exactly the same type of thing that you would expect. You would just see this much smaller portion of the image. So in order for us to combat this, we have to do what we were talking about before, and that is to use a smaller focal length. If we use a smaller focal length, then we'll get the same field of view. We're still losing resolution, right? Because we're using, this is a 0.5 megapixel sensor compared to a 6 megapixel sensor. But now if we're using a smaller focal length, we're now capturing the same angle of view, right? Even though now the difference is that it's the same angle of view, we're still capturing a lot of photons, but the difference is that we have lost a lot of resolution. So what I'm trying to show you here is that all of these things are related very tightly together. If you want to have a smaller sensor, you can, but you have to make a decision. Are you going to keep the pixel size the same and capture all of this light, or are you going to reduce the size of the pixels and maintain resolution, but then you capture fewer photons? This is an important distinction, an important difference that we have to consider between these two sensors and between these two cameras when we're looking at the two of them from a technology point of view. So let's assume for a moment that we're using appropriately sized focal length lenses on each of these cameras. So these cameras are identical except for their sensors. One sensor is much smaller than the other, and now their lenses are also slightly different. So there's a much smaller lens attached to the camera with the smaller sensor that gives us this field of view that matches the photo that would be taken from the camera on the right with the larger sensor and the larger lens. What happens in effect is something, there's another problem here. Now, if I ask the same question, do we receive fewer photons from the camera on with the smaller sensor and the smaller lens than we do on the camera that has a larger sensor and a larger lens? We do. Why? Why are we receiving fewer photons if the pixel sizes are the same now? What is? Which area? Okay, good. It's related to that. It does deal with the area, but it's not the area of the sensor, it's the area of the aperture. If these two lenses have the same aperture ratio, that means that, remember, what is the aperture? What is the F number? That was something, the ratio of something to something else. The focal length divided by the diameter, right? So if I have a smaller lens, if I have a smaller focal length on one camera and I'm keeping the F number the same, let's just say F4, for example, and I'm using a 4mm lens over here and now a 1mm lens over here, that means that our focal length, in order to maintain the same ratio of F4, we have to change the diameter. The aperture itself also has to shrink if we are going to keep the same F number for this lens. So for a large lens, let's say we have a lens, here, we'll write this down again so we can make it a little bit more concrete. So let's say we said that F number is the same thing as the focal length divided by the diameter. So let's say I have these two lenses again. And if I have these two lenses, one of them has a focal length of 4mm, for example. And I have another focal length that's equal to something much smaller, like 2mm. Okay? Now, in order for us to maintain an F number of F4, that means that the diameter of the aperture of this bigger lens has to be what? 4 equals 4 divided by something, so we would expect this something to just be 1mm. Now, if we did the same math, remember that what's causing us all of this pain and confusion is the fact that some jerk decided early on that it'd be a good idea to talk about these F numbers in terms of ratios. So it's this ratio that is causing a little bit of a headache, but we can correct for this ratio. So we're saying now, what I am telling you is that in order for us to capture the same amount of the scene, we have to use a smaller lens, right? We talked about this in the first hour, this multiplication factor that exists because we're cropping out the center portion of the image. We can therefore use a smaller lens to get the same angle of view that this larger lens would have. Okay, so because of this, I have to use on my smaller sensor a smaller lens, a smaller focal length. But if both of these pictures were taken at F4, that means that the smaller lens also has a smaller diameter. The diameter of this lens now has to be 0.5 millimeters to satisfy this condition that the F number remain at F4. Because 2 divided by 0.5, that's F4. 4 divided by 1, that's F4. So you can see that when we shrunk now this camera, we didn't just shrink the sensor, we also shrunk the aperture. So now this aperture is much smaller than the one from the bigger lens. So just by nature of the fact that this is a smaller camera, we have a smaller aperture, and going way back to our talk about F number and aperture, having a smaller aperture by itself with everything else, ignoring everything else, means that we are collecting fewer photons. There's a smaller range through which these photons can come through, and this sensor on the left is not going to get as many photons per pixel as this sensor would here. Even though these pixels are the same size, it doesn't matter. What does change because of this decrease in size is the size of the aperture, so we're getting fewer photons that we can sense on each of these sensors. Now, this is actually what's very important and what leads us to this idea that we have this difference between the two. There is, not all cameras are created equally, especially when we're talking about size. So I'm going to show you an image now. And this image is basically shows us what we already know. We know that a smaller camera will look like it has a much longer depth of field. So look at the middle portion of this image. This is taken with a Canon S70, which is a compact camera, and it was taken with the following specifications. It was taken at 8 millimeters, which is the focal length of this image, at f3.5, at 1/8 of a second, at ISO 50. Now, let's assume that we use all of the same exposure values on a larger camera, on a Canon 1D Mark II, which is a large camera. It has not quite full frame, but almost full frame sized sensor. And we take it at 28 millimeters. If we actually perform this difference, this factor, or rather this focal length multiplication factor, we find out that we are using essentially, we're getting equivalent field of views, as you can see. I mean, we're capturing the same amount of each of these scenes in both of these. But what you're seeing is confirming what you already know, and that is that this bigger camera gives us a larger, or rather a shallower depth of field. And so we see at the end of this ruler, for example, that it's blurrier in this image with the bigger camera than it is with the smaller camera. But you can't forget the fact that we have scaled down the camera, everything about the camera, for this compact version of this photo. So when we took this photo with this Canon S70, everything had to shrink. The sensor had to shrink. The lens had to shrink. The aperture had to shrink. What the limiting factor is here, not the fact that the sensor itself is smaller, but the fact that the aperture is smaller. That is what is making the difference here. That this, the aperture of this, this one right here, this middle value, is actually, if we actually calculate the size of the aperture, it's actually 2.3 millimeters. We can calculate this aperture because we know the focal length is 8 millimeters. We know the F number is 3.5. So if we actually did the math, get rid of this stuff here. If we actually did the math, and I said, let's see, the focal length is 8 millimeters. So 3.5 equals 8 divided by something. So we can just do 8 divided by 3.5 to get the answer that we want. So let's see, calculator, 8. 3.5 divide, we can see that the size, that the diameter of this aperture is 2.3 millimeters. Just based on what we already know, right? Nothing fancy going on here, just based on the fact that we know that the F number is equal to the ratio of the focal length divided by the diameter. Now let's do the same calculation with this camera here. It's 28 millimeters. At the same ratio, f3.5, that means that the size of the aperture is going to be something altogether different. So 28 millimeters, f number of 3.5, so that means that we get a diameter of actually 8 millimeters. If you don't believe me, you can calculate this, but I pre-calculated this. I know that it is 8 millimeters, or it's close enough to 8 millimeters to call it this, okay? So what we are saying is that the diameter of the aperture is much bigger in this camera. Just because it is a bigger camera, does it have a larger aperture at this focal length? Okay? Now, what happens if we make this bigger camera with this bigger lens use a diameter, an aperture diameter that matches that of the smaller camera? Would we get the same amount of depth of field out of this bigger camera that we would? So let's calculate this again, but this time let's figure out what the F number would be for this big camera if I had a focal length of 28 millimeters and a diameter to match this one, 2.3 millimeters. 2.3 millimeters. So what I do here is I take 28 millimeters and I divide it by 2.3. So let's do that math here. Where's my mouse? 28 divided by, did I say 2.3? Yes, 2.3. We can see that we get an F number of 12, okay? So what this means is that at F12, the actual aperture size on the bigger camera will be the same as the actual aperture size in the smaller camera. So let's take this same photo again and see what happens. So unfortunately on the camera there's no f12, but there is an f13, and that's close enough, and the result is the very top image. And look how it is essentially identical in terms of its depth of field to this smaller camera. So yes, the F number is higher, but recall that the F number is just the ratio. We corrected for the ratio. We're using now the exact same size of aperture, and we now can get the same image as a result. Yes?
I'm curious, did you get more of the pen in the original of that top image that just got cropped when you put the three together?
So notice that I didn't actually take this image. I stole it from somebody else. But yes, presumably all of these images are identical, except that the top one is just a much narrower crop compared to the bottom two. So presumably you would still see the pen just as easily if we were able to view the original images in all three. Okay, so hopefully now this makes sense. Hopefully you can see that our bigger camera does have the capability of taking a photo that has just as much depth of field as the smaller camera. We just have to correct for the difference in size. So we've corrected for the difference in size by recomputing the F number that would be appropriate at that focal length for this larger camera, but that means that something else has to change. If I'm going to keep the shutter speed the same in all three of these images, and I want to change the F number on this big camera, what does that mean? What do I have to change? That means something has to change, right? What is changing? So if the shutter speed is the same, then it's actually ISO that changes. Right, so obviously we have to change some other values. So the end goal here is that I want to be able to take the same image from all three of these cameras, or rather from both of these cameras. I want them to have identical depth of field. I want them to have identical shutter speed, because if I change the shutter speed, then I don't know, it just seems it's not the same image. So I can increase the ISO by a corresponding amount to get. So I can change either the ISO or the shutter speed by a corresponding amount to get the correct exposure based up here. Now, had I kept the ISO of this bottommost one at ISO 50 and 1/8 of a second, then it would be the same exposure. But if I change the ISO by a corresponding amount, this actually implies that there is this additional problem. This goes back to that other problem that we were talking about when we changed the sensor sizes, and that was that the smaller sensor is receiving fewer photons, so it's getting less signal, right? It's getting less signal. And in this term that we call signal-to-noise ratio, there's this term that is called the signal-to-noise ratio. The higher the signal is, the better quality it's going to be. The lower the signal is, that means that we're going to get more noise, and it's just going to be a noisier image. And in fact, this is precisely the reason why this other feature, so-called, of compact cameras comes into play. You might say, okay, well, another thing, besides the fact that compact cameras seem to exhibit larger than normal depth of field, is that they also seem noisier. There's just more noise in these compact cameras. And this, again, is emulated by the fact that I can effectively increase the ISO of my large camera and get, in the end, the same signal-to-noise ratio that I would in the smaller camera as well. So I would get just as much noise. And again, there's enough light here that this is not really apparent. What's most important from this image was this depth of field discussion. But it does also tell us why these compact cameras also have worse noise, beyond the fact that they have... it's directly related to the fact, rather than beyond the fact, that these smaller cameras also get fewer photons. So the electronics have to work harder, so to speak, to give us the result, to give us the image that we actually see in all of these pictures. Okay? Any questions on this before we move on? I know this is a little bit hard to wrap your mind around at first, but just so long as you realize that because we're scaling down a camera, We also have to therefore scale down the size of the aperture as well. And if we make the aperture, the actual aperture size, the same between the large and small cameras, we can effectively emulate that of the two. Yes?
Before digital photography, there was film that you have to perform, and the film would correspond to a sensor. Is that right?
Well, film only. Well, film really only came in a couple of sizes. There was the, the 35 millimeter was the most popular film, and then you would also have, they did have this APS-C film, which was a smaller version that smaller cameras would have. And it was the same sort of idea there, where you would have to use, in order to get the same field of view, there's nothing special about it being film. You would then also have to scale down the lenses a little bit to get the same field of view in an APS-C film than you would in a 35 millimeter film. But it wasn't as much of an issue because film was never scaled down quite as much as we've scaled down digital sensors today. So while we did have a variety of sizes, they were usually 35 millimeters, APS-C, and bigger. Like you would have the large format, the medium format cameras, and yes, we still have those today, but nowadays are these really small cameras very popular, and now are we really seeing these problems apparent in the new cameras. But had we had these smaller film sensors, or had we had smaller rolls of film, we would have the same problem there as well. If they were correspondingly small, 6 times smaller than a 35 millimeter frame of film, that'd be a tiny little camera, and be the same problem here. Yes?
Well, reel to film camera, like 8 millimeter or 16 millimeter film.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of scaling, yeah, but it's different.
So 8 millimeter and 16 millimeter, like that video type of film, is probably what you're referring to. I mean, that really is, it's the same problem. You still have to scale down the size of the lenses if you want to get the same field of view. There's nothing intrinsic about the fact that this is digital. It's just that now, because we see this much more prevalently, has become a recent issue. But it's a limitation of physics rather than limitation of digital, if that difference makes sense. Okay. So we've talked a bit about the different sizes of pixels. So if we have these three different buckets, for example, let's say we have this bucket on the far left. This is the pixel that you might see, and it's just a representation of a pixel that could be SLR sized, for example. Let's say you have 4 photons coming in and it fills it this much. Now, this is another downside to having a compact camera. If you have a smaller pixel, what's going to happen is that it's also going to fill up more quickly with the same number of photons. So very quickly will it become inundated with photons. So we can see that if the bucket is half as wide, the same number of pixels are going to make it fill twice as much. So just by nature of the fact that this pixel is smaller, do we have a smaller dynamic range? Just because these smaller pixels can't hold quite so many photons within them. So we would say that in our equation that we talked about for dynamic range, where the dynamic range is the full signal, or the full bucket divided by the smallest signal, or the littlest bucket, that we have this size become a problem for us as well. These smaller pixels just simply cannot hold as many photons as the bigger buckets. And this is one very big reason why compact cameras will never have the capability in terms of dynamic range that the larger cameras will have, just because of this fact right here. Now, there is another way that we could improve the dynamic range of a compact camera. And in fact, you've seen compact cameras have more megapixels in them for the same size sensor, right? Which means that the pixels are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And that certainly is the case. But what's happening is that we are fixing with technology not the high part, not the biggest signal. We're not making the bucket any bigger. We're not making it any more capable of capturing a very large signal, but in fact, we're fixing this part, the smallest detectable signal. We're getting better at being able to detect fewer and fewer photons with less error. So if we can detect fewer photons, that has the same effect. If we have a very small value at the bottom here, that has the same effect as having a very large value up top. Now, in an ideal world, we would be doing both. We would be making bigger pixel sensors in addition to our improved electronics, and we would have crazy dynamic range now. But you know, it's very much becoming a marketing thing where people, they, you know, you guys want your megapixels. So what we're seeing is smaller, well, not you guys, hopefully, but, you know, people in general want their megapixels. So that means that we're seeing smaller pixels, but thanks to the progress of technology, we're able to read the smaller detectable signals even better, which means that we can get, we're marginally improving dynamic range even as we make these signals just a little bit smaller. So just to nail this home a little bit, so we can, if we want to fill up this one with fewer photons, you can see that it has the same amount of relative value as this one here, but fewer photons means that there's going to be a greater amount of read noise, or in other words, there's going to always be a certain amount of noise that occurs when we try to read the value of photons. You know, we'll talk about this later, so on and so forth. So this, in general, because it captures fewer photons, we'll have a bit more read noise. And so this decreases our signal-to-noise ratio. We're having less signal, like what I was telling you before, we're having less signal, and that, therefore we are going to have just a little bit more noise. But again, luckily, as technology progresses, we are getting a little bit better at detecting these very small signals. But still, there's definitely a hard limit. We haven't gotten there yet, but there's definitely a hard limit to how many photons we can capture before we're not able to read anymore, just because they're not going to be present. One photon versus zero photons certainly does make a difference. So again, this brings up this point of using the raw format over JPEG. You can capture all of the signal that's given to us off of your sensor, and you can modify your image so that you can maximize the image quality off of it. Now, there's an important thing that we can talk about in terms of dynamic range, and that is how ISO actually works. Up until now, we've always talked about ISO in terms of sensitivity, and it's not really that the sensor becomes any more sensitive. It's just that we're performing some tricks to make it appear this way, and specifically what's happening is that with higher ISOs, we essentially are calling certain portions of the bucket to actually be full. So in other words, let's say we have ISO 100 that looks like this. We can fill up our bucket completely with photons, and as soon as this bucket completely fills up, then that's, you know, a completely bright pixel, completely white, and that we are able to get a certain dynamic range out of this because we're able to capture a lot of photons divided by a minimum amount. But as we increase the ISO, just even to ISO 200, what this means is that at half the value, we're essentially doubling all of the values. So we're only going to about halfway, and we're doubling everything. So at a half full, we are calling this bucket to be bright at ISO 200. This is just a trick that camera manufacturers are able to do to not actually modify the sensor in any way. They can just use these tricks to say, okay, if I want something to be twice as bright, then all I have to do is capture half as many photons and just double it. Just double the number of photons that I'm reading, and that will have this effect of having this higher sensitivity. But this does have a downside, right? Because now what we're saying is that the full bucket of this value here, of this ISO 200, is less than the full bucket of ISO 100. So therefore, we might expect our dynamic range to change slightly as we increase the ISO of our cameras, because our full bucket, we don't have quite as large of a biggest detectable signal for a full bucket in ISO 200 that we would in ISO 100. And in fact, this is certainly the case. In every digital camera, every time you bump up the ISO, you are decreasing your dynamic range by a certain amount. And it's not quite as bad, frankly, as it looks here. It's not quite as bad as losing one stop of dynamic range every time you bump up by one ISO, or every time you double the ISO. And the reason for that is just by nature of the beast, every time we double these, our error actually gets a little bit better for the smallest detectable signal. So we can actually, with our electronics, we actually can get a slightly better signal at the low end when we increase the ISO. The end effect being that it's not quite as bad as losing one stop of dynamic range with every additional stop of ISO, but we do lose dynamic range. You are going to get the maximum dynamic range out of your camera at its, well, and for many cameras, at its lowest ISO setting. Some of them have what's called a low ISO setting that you can enable outside, and it basically has the inverse effect where it halves all of the values. And that is not what I'm talking about here. There's usually it's ISO 100. On some cameras, it's actually ISO 200 if that's the minimum that your camera will go to. But basically, the minimum ISO is the maximum amount of dynamic range that you're going to get out of your camera just because of the way that this works here. Now, we do have a variety of sensors that are available as well. The two major varieties are the active pixel sensors and the passive pixel sensors. The passive pixel sensors are the ones that you see very commonly in compact digital cameras. They're the CCD. They're very, very prevalent these days. Now, what's nice about CCD is that they're relatively low noise. But the downside is that they also use a little bit more energy. So what happens is that in compact cameras, we're using CCDs to combat the noise issue. We're using a little bit less noise, but the downside is that we're also using more energy. This is just one of many reasons why compact cameras do not have the battery life that a larger SLR has, and it's just because of the type of sensor that it has, the CCD sensor. Now, many digital SLRs actually have CMOS, or an active pixel sensor. This is nice because it's very, very low power. The downside is that it has a little bit more noise. Now, you might say, well, that seems silly because digital SLRs in general seem to have less noise than their compact camera brethren. But the fact is that we're also dealing with much larger sensors. The fact that this sensor is many times larger, CMOS sensor is many times larger than a compact camera CCD, far overcomes this downside of having slightly higher noise. So we could use CCD in a digital SLR. The downside is that we would just get a marginal increase in signal. We would get a marginal decrease, in other words, of noise, but at the expense of having a much larger or a much worse battery life. So for this reason, digital SLRs typically use CMOS. Compact cameras typically use CCD, and Nikon 1 year got really fancy. They decided to create their own active pixel sensor called JFET LBCast. There's a variety of other ones. This is just an example. Sometimes you'll hear them. You'll hear manufacturers love to talk about their own specific type of sensor, but usually they will say it's a derivative of a CMOS or a CCD camera, and you can remember that the properties that are available through each of those. And luckily for each of you that are here today, I actually have a video about how CCDs are made. You might recall from a couple of weeks ago when I showed that video about how lenses are made. This is from that same program, talking instead about CCDs. Oh, anticlimactic.
Is the image sensor in a digital camera or camcorder. When you snap the shutter or press record, you expose the CCD to patterns of light. It captures them electronically by converting them into millions of electrical charges. The camera's processor then reads these charges and translates them into pictures or movies. CCDs, or charge-coupled devices, are made of silicon, the main element in sand. What's special about silicon? When light hits it, you get electrons. Production begins with a round silicon wafer, 6 inches in diameter, and about as thick as a shirt cardboard. It goes into a steam oven for 3 to 4 hours. The intense heat, along with oxygen and hydrogen gases in the steam, create a glass-like layer on the wafer. This insulates the silicon against the miniature electrical circuitry that will be built on top of it. But first, the wafer is covered in conductive material. This layer measures less than a micron. A human hair is 100 times thicker. Next, a robot applies a 1 micron thick layer of photosensitive resin, which will undergo a chemical reaction when exposed to light. A technician places a mask over the wafer. The pattern on this mask is the schematic for part of the circuitry. When you take a picture, you expose the silicon wafer to light, and that generates electrons. The circuitry carries those electrons to the camera's processor, which reads the charges and translates them into an image. This machine exposes the masked wafer to ultraviolet light. The resin underneath the circuitry pattern remains intact, protecting the conductive layer beneath it. The resin on the areas not masked by the circuitry pattern needs to be removed. Chemicals are sprayed on. This dissolves the resin, exposing the conductive layer underneath. Technicians repeat this entire process with anywhere from 13 to 30 masks until they've built up the full circuitry pattern on the wafer. Next, technicians submerge the wafer in acid, which eats away the uncovered conductive layer. So now, the only conductive material left on the wafer is the actual circuitry. Next step, a thorough rinsing in tap water to remove the residue. Then a rinse with purified water to remove any impurities left by the tap water. Throughout production, contamination is a concern. A single speck of dust can ruin an entire wafer. To protect and insulate the circuitry, the wafer is coated in liquid glass, then baked for 2 hours until the glass hardens. The wafer surface is divided into 25 million tiny square cells called pixels. When you take a photo, each pixel records the light intensity of a minute portion of the scene, generating an electrical charge. A filter on the CCD translates each pixel charge into color. The company makes this filter with three pigment powders: red, green, and blue. These three colors combined in varying ratios can reproduce any color. The camera's processor reads and then reconstructs the photograph scene pixel by pixel. Each finished CCD undergoes a battery of automated tests to ensure that all the circuits are functional. The machine marks faulty circuits with ink. Just one bad circuit means the entire CCD needs to be discarded. Technicians then check every CCD under a microscope, looking for scratches that might have occurred during the production process. The number of pixels on a CCD varies, depending on what type of camera it's for. This one is a 25 megapixel CCD, meaning it has 25 million pixels. This company even produces a single CCD that has 111 megapixels. So the next time you say cheese, remember that you're producing a digital photo thanks to all that painstaking work that went into the sophisticated CCD semiconductor inside your camera.
Now, some of those cameras, they do sound like they have quite a lot of megapixels, but typically what you would see is that in these very high megapixel CCDs, they're typically used for like astrophotography. So a lot of astronomers and researchers that take pictures of the sky definitely need a lot of the low noise that a CCD could provide for that. And so that's most likely what they're referring to in this particular case. Now, one of the things that they also mentioned that we really haven't talked about quite yet is the fact that most sensors actually do not capture directly any color. And I know this looks really confusing, but don't worry, you're not expected to know it. And we'll talk more about it next week. But I just want to tell you something as a bit of a teaser for next week, and that is that digital cameras by themselves cannot sense color. They can only sense variations in the brightness. And so there's something that we have to do to be able to sense the color in an actual pixel. And what all of that is and how all of this relates back to it, we will talk about in more detail next week. So until then, thank you all for coming, and we will see you then.